Isn't it interesting that when the man of God gives up, God sends Bedouins? Or is it that Bedouins practice their hospitality as they know how, even for the man the king wants to kill, the hunted man? So indigeneity is on my mind today, the way God acts among us, the people of the land when the nation builders arrive, who bless us to this day with their beauty and compassion.
That's the Reverend Winnie Varghese, and today she brings you a powerful message entitled Walk in Beauty. I'm Katie Givens-Keim, and this is Day One. Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Hello, friends. I'm your host, Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim. And today on Day One, we are honored to have with us the Reverend Winnie Varghese. Winnie is rector of St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Atlanta, Georgia. Before becoming the 23rd rector of St. Luke's in 2021, she served as priest for ministry and program coordinator at Trinity Church Wall Street in New York City. Prior to that, she was rector and priest in charge at St. Mark's in the Bowery and also a campus chaplain. A published author and editor, Winnie attended Agnes Scott College in Decatur, Georgia, and earned her bachelor's degree from Southern Methodist University in Dallas. She earned her Master of Divinity from Union Theological Seminary in New York. Winnie, welcome to Day One. Welcome back to Day One.
Ah, thanks. It's so nice to be with you in this new way to be Day One.
A new day for Day One. Well, last year, I think actually it was just about exactly this time last year when you were on the Day One program, listeners heard about your journey of ministry from serving in New York City, one of the leading Episcopal congregations in the world, and then coming from there to St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Atlanta. And now you're a few years into your leadership at St. Luke. Tell us just a little bit, like, you know, what excites you most about life in your congregation right now?
You know, we're so fortunate. St. Luke's is this really bustling congregation, and we're growing, I mean, weirdly, with young families. It's wild. I think there are ways that you can market for that. And that, I'm just going to say, that is not a strength of the Episcopal Church or of me, of like how you like market for people. But I am someone that believes the gospel is compelling. And so if you can remove the barriers to hearing the good news, people want to be a part of it. And that has just been the truth everywhere I've been. But because St. Luke's is big, when you remove barriers in a big place, a lot of people come. It happens fast. A couple of Sundays ago, I was looking down, and St. Luke's has done this for a long time. We invite kids to come stand at the altar with us. It's an interesting question, because are we just using them as props? Like, what are we doing, right? So we invite them to come. They don't have to come. And it's really for little kids. And they like it. And then they stop liking it, and then they don't come anymore. And so there's these some little kids. They're so great. One little child asks when it's time to get up on the stage. This Sunday, I saw a child whose older sibling, who was a toddler, was going up. And so you could see the mom like hurriedly trying to put the shoes on a very insistent little baby that wanted to go up with her sister and wasn't ready yet. So I was looking down this Sunday, and I realized there were all these kids from at least biracial to multiracial families. And they were watching each other. They weren't watching their siblings. They were watching other kids that were a little bit older than them. And kids are deep this way, right? They recognize that these were kids like them, and they were standing watching them. And I was thinking, oh my God, is this everything we're supposed to do at church? That we've made this is a very formal, large space. We've made it tender because children are kind of goofing around being kids up there, but they're literally watching one another, which is the whole point of the exercise, to walk alongside them and to bring them close to the holiest place. And one child's mother was saying that she's tried out for a choir, something like that, and she's a very shy child, and that standing up in front of people with no expectation and just watching them watch her has given her the confidence to stand up in front of people, which is a remarkable leadership skill to have. So it's got me away from my own sense of like, there has to be a function. What's the theological function? And am I just using them? Is it right? You know, and it's gotten me to, oh my God, suffer the little children to come unto me is, oh, it causes, whenever children are present, I bet this has always been true. When children are around, we see things through their eyes. And if we don't have them around, we don't. And so putting them up there refreshes even the view of all of us trying to figure out how to make this Eucharist happen and whether this two-year-old is going to make it from back there in time. And, you know, and all these little children that have had to like go leaping off the steps into the arms of their father because they've like to get to watch these people parent, right? These young adults parent. This is the thing I'm most excited about. Like, you can't make it happen, but when it happens, it's like, oh, this is what people want. They're not just petty and want their church to be sustained forever. They want to see through the eyes of children again. And I don't mean that this church is petty, but you know, they say that if when churches want young families, that they're just, it's sort of exploitative or, you know, it's problematic. Like, oh, actually maybe deeply, deeply, they know they need to see through these eyes. They need those eyes in the room. It's beautiful.
Winnie, that is beautiful. And you know, it reminds me, I hadn't thought about this, but the whole making sure we see each other part is so key. I did this thing by accident once where I was performing a wedding and I just had them turn around because I'm like, are they going to have their backs to people the whole time? I'm like, let's just, the two of you look at these people and look at each other and we're in a place that's sacred. Like, let's just sit, like, you should be to take this in, drink
yeah.
it in.
Yeah.
But what you're saying makes me think like we should have lots of moments where we kind of look at each other in sacred place, in sacred time, you know?
Yeah. St. Martin the Bowery was in the round and people would cry. It was a cry church. St. Luke's is too. It's clearly something I like in church. People just weepy in church. And at St. Mark's, people were so wrecked. It's like, what are we doing? What are we getting so right that people get in here and are like emotionally present? So I was watching to try to understand at what point in our brilliantly constructed service was this happening. It was before we had said a word. It was that they were sitting in the round in this kind of soaring sacred space, right? Built for something very special and looking at one another, kind of exposed yes. in some ways on this at these chairs. And they just, like, it just opened their hearts.
That's gorgeous. There's so much there. Oh, yes. Well, speaking of like people seeing each other and stitching things together, I want to ask you, so I think I'm late to the party in terms of my knowledge of changes planned for the city of Atlanta, but every time I hear about this thing, I think like, oh my goodness, all American cities should hear about this. Could you just say more about the stitch? And I know it's connecting downtown and midtown Atlanta. And I think you mentioned in your episode last year, stitch.
Yeah.
Do tell.
It's fascinating. In the same world of coming out of church governance, it's the same category of thing, of symbolic thing versus practical thing. So the idea is that there are a number of bridges right where I am, where downtown and midtown come together, because there's this thing called the downtown connector, which was actually a downtown divider, a highway that just runs right through downtown, like all of our downtowns, right? In the same era, New York had the same thing. They defeated some of this in the East Village, yeah. right?
Robert Moses,
yeah. That like you efficiently get people to their jobs downtown and to their homes in the suburbs, and everybody and it's in the wake is just everything is destroyed. Like the whole Lower East yeah. Side would have been destroyed, and they fought it and they won. Buttermilk Bottom was the neighborhood in Atlanta that was just devastated. Buttermilk, mm-hmm. because buttermilk was given to Black people. It is the product that comes after butter is made, right? I love buttermilk. It's kind of it's good for you. It's how you make fried chicken and biscuits. It's leavening, but it's the waste in some ways. It's not the cream. It's not the butter. So Buttermilk Bottom was an African-American neighborhood. And this highway destroyed it. And it would have been right adjacent to us. It's where the old Fourth Ward is. The old Fourth Ward, you can see it all over Atlanta, the neighborhoods that are just cut by where the highway went through, right? I live in one in Collier Hills. And so the idea is these bridges that were built over the highway that cut through everything, that if they could connect the area between the bridges, you kind of stitch together the city, because in the process of tearing it up with this highway, you've separated parts of downtown, which again, happened all over the country, right? Really crappy post-war urban planning, very racist. So they're going to build this lid basically over the highway, which is what I've been calling it. It's like a hat. And the lucky for us, the shortest section between two bridges really falls into our yard. And there's nothing else on this side, on the north side, but our yard. Yeah. All the good luck in the world. And there are a couple of different stages. And you can Google it. It's, you know, that's what they're posted. And when I got there, we didn't know which one we'd be, and which there's two stages that fall onto our property, but one that comes into our yard, the other comes into a parking lot. And then there's another one over by Georgia Tech and another one further south. I think, I don't even know what direction, cause it's all kind of loopy. So it's interesting cause it's like $750 million is what it'll cost to do the whole thing. It's a $1 billion project, right? And it will create parks and green space because it's just space over a highway. The question I think that will come at some point is if we invested $750 million in, you know, in equity, you know, in our city, like that would be a story to tell. Yeah. But the way the world goes, you know, the person that gives the gift for the investments is not, you know, it's a different person than has given the gift for the outreach center. And so it's not necessarily money that's fungible or that we can move, but nope. I think right. that at some point that conversation will have to be had because it's $1 billion for something that will be beautiful and increase, what is it, increase the value of the land and a lot of, increase the amount of developable space basically in downtown and midtown.
Yeah, it's really great. I think it's not a story just for Atlanta though. It's a story for so many cities, and that's really exciting. I love they call it the Stitch.
The Stitch.
Winnie, your perspective and your wisdom are often sought after in your denomination's convenings. And as a published author, you even wrote a book back a couple years ago about the future and structure of the Episcopal Church. And so much has changed since then, of course, in American churches and in the world. There, I'm sure that the list would be long, but just what are some of the changes you find really striking as you, especially since, I mean, the investment of like thinking through a book project on something and then living through how it happens or doesn't happen or, you know, all the things. I'm just curious what yeah. changes come to mind for you.
You know, what's amazing about that project is we had passed resolutions basically saying to the church when Catherine Jeffert Shorey was our presiding bishop. So this is two presiding, you know, this oh, is a while yeah. ago, saying we got to reorganize this thing. It's too top heavy. It's too expensive and the church is declining and there's new ways to think about things. And then, but the way we're structured, that has to happen through general convention. The staff can't really do that, including the presiding bishop. And we've just elected a presiding bishop on the platform that he will do this restructuring, which is fascinating to me because he doesn't really control all the levers that could do it. So I'm intrigued by that. But we talked about reorganizing dioceses, consolidating dioceses after just having a period of establishing more dioceses. Like, so I was from Los Angeles, LA split into San Diego and El Camino Real and Los Angeles, New York has split into New York and Long Island. So now we're consolidating because of population shifts. So mm-hmm. Northwestern Pennsylvania has fewer people living in it just literally than in its prime, like all these Rust Belt areas. And so there's this consolidation that we had kind of, that was predicted and that was in that book. And it's happening. Like the Diocese of Wisconsin is a thing now. It was two or three before. There's now a Diocese of Wisconsin, of the whole state.
Just all of Wisconsin. Yep.
There's now like a Diocese of the Great Lakes, which is Eastern and Western Michigan. There used to be three dioceses in Michigan, another two. And that's happening, like that consolidation is happening. And I think the exploration of what technology might mean for us in terms of what we have to do everywhere locally. The other side of that though is I don't think we can like efficiency our way to growth and mission. Like in the same way that you can't like cut your budget to growth is the way I tend to talk about it in churches. You can't like mm-hmm. reduce for growth. And like the church has to be mission. Or we don't need to be.
Yeah.
Like it can't just be us kind of tending the survivors, which is, I think, sometimes how we talk about ourselves. So I think about all those kids mm-hmm. standing there. I want to be a church for those kids and for their families. And that's, you know, St. Luke should be here in 100 years. It should be thriving and serving and proclaiming. So I think the other side of that is that mission is always local. It's in the land. And the brilliance of our tradition is when it's very, very local. And I don't know that you can force local from the center. In some ways, like the big institution is a colonial institution. Like that's why we control from a distance, right? But then there's a part of me, a big part of me that would say, I didn't sign up for a free church tradition. I want like that, the heft and force of a big institution on the side of the good. And I feel like that's the moment we have, is how do we get that right? And also when we were first thinking about that, when that book was coming out, people were trying to figure out how to be a church if there was a woman in charge. Could we still do that? Should we break up? You know, what about Gene Robinson? Like all that was live. What's wild is 2024, it is not live in our church anymore. We get to do ministry.
Yeah.
It's amazing how fast that is.
For that.
It's so fast, right? It's so fast. I feel like I want to tell my colleagues around the world, like once you make those decisions, you get to be free.
Truly. It's really hopeful. It's hopeful to look at how fast. Sometimes it's terrifying to see how fast change happens,
yeah.
But sometimes it's really hopeful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Winnie, what was your first memory of God?
So I grew up in church, grew up around church folks, pious and faithful people. But my first memory of God is this. When I was 17, I kind of came out to myself. I had this moment of like, oh, I'm gay. That's what it is. It was completely intellectual. I had no idea what that would mean. But I had this moment of like, oh, and it felt so true. I was like, oh, like I literally felt like I was inhabiting my body. Like I had let myself know something I couldn't let myself know before because I wouldn't know what the future was. But I remember as I was thinking it through, I was like, oh, I'm like, nobody I know will receive this. The people I love won't receive this. I remember thinking, oh, I'm so alone. And then I remember thinking, oh no, God loves me. And I don't know how to say it, but God, like I felt in the presence of God in a way that I think I had never thought about it before because I didn't have to, because my parents held that. Like for so many of us, our parents hold faith so we can resist it, right? Like, oh. But in that moment, I remember thinking like, I couldn't think of a person that I truly, like deeply loved who would receive this information, like without needing to correct it or change it or be really angry. And then knowing, like without a, like just knowing there were, like, I was with God, which I don't know. I've wondered what to say to people who've never had that experience. And I could not have been more shocked. I was ready. I was a very rational Protestant person in many ways, you know, and then it all ended in that moment. I was like, oh, this is very real.
Sounds almost mystical.
It felt that way. I had a very clear sense in the same moment, although it was happening, that I was supposed to be a priest. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, well, how does that work? And like, are there women priests? I had never heard of that. Like, it really felt like a call, like a sense of awareness that was so, it was very profound for me.
Now listen for God's word as we hear from the first book of Kings, chapter 19, verses 4 through 8.
A reading from Kings. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree. He asked that he might die. It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my ancestors. Then he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. Suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, get up and eat. He looked, and there at his head was a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came a second time, touched him and said, get up and eat, otherwise the journey will be too much for you. He got up and ate and drank. Then he went in the strength of that food for 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God.
Now, Reverend Winnie Varghese's sermon entitled, Walk in Beauty.
The readings for today have me thinking about indigeneity, being indigenous people, the people of the land, and food that lasts. It has me thinking about it because Robert Alter, in his one little footnote on this section, in his wonderful comprehensive study and translation of the Hebrew Bible, has one footnote for this passage, and it just says, bread baked on hot stones is still prepared in this way by the Bedouin. This is Bedouin bread. A rabbi friend recently shared an article about the idea of indigenous being a thoroughly modern and postmodern idea. And as you can imagine, the reason they were sharing that is in the conflict in Gaza and between Israel and Palestine, who are indigenous takes on a very different twist than we're used to thinking about here in the United States. And the article, the argument is that the idea of indigeneity and of being indigenous comes from colonialism in the colonial period. Made a lot of sense as soon as I read it. I hadn't thought about it in quite that way before. So it's not a way of authenticating as much as it's a political reality. It is a way of being because of colonialism. Colonialism does something to the people that are already on the land when colonists arrive. So it's not an endless going back in history to find the most old past and who lived where originally or who at some point in history was on some piece of land, because as we're finding, that can be endless. It's literally about colonialism happening to you or to your ancestors or in your doing in the modern era. After 1492, and you might remember the song, Columbus Sails the Ocean Blue, and where I'm from, Vasco da Gama, went the other way and found us. And wrestling with the violence of what that means, what that meant at that time, what it means for us today, produces the idea of indigenous, that people were there, that there is no empty land with no people. So colonialism, either exploitative colonialism, like what happened in India, where I'm from, which is the East India Company coming and taking as much as they could for profit at home, or settler colonialism, which we hear about a lot in this country because people came here, people like me, and we live here now and continue to come here. Exploitative colonialism is when colonizers, usually corporations, take stuff. All the stuff for their own wealth. And settler colonialism is exactly what it sounds like, claiming land and a place for us as outsiders to stay, giving away the land of the indigenous or stealing it. So indigeneity is fascinating to me because I am a person whose ancestors are from a place where we've been for a very long time. We might feel indigenous to it, though I'm guessing people that live in the forests or tribal communities in that place feel much more indigenous to it than we do that live in cities. But I currently live in a place in Atlanta, Georgia. I grew up in Dallas, Texas. I've lived in New York most of my adult life. I live in a place where others have been removed forcibly for us to be here, for us to live in the ways that we live in this place. So I'm thinking about it for two reasons. One, Elijah finds bread when he awakes in the wilderness. As Robert Alter says, Bedouin bread, today prepared in the same way. It's today the same people found in that place. Local people, but not the children of Israel or the Hebrew people, and not the Philistines or all the ites and eens that you read about when you read the Bible. It never says Bedouin. We actually never hear of them in the Bible. But there they are, or rather, there is their bread, made the way they still make it today. There are still Bedouin from Morocco to Iraq, with different kinds of rites in all of those different North African and Middle Eastern countries. But primarily exactly where they are in this story, or where we find their bread, in the area of Sinai. Horeb is Sinai. A bread left there for the man of God, and plenty of it, and a vessel of water for that fleeing man, the stranger, enough for a very hungry man to eat twice and be well fortified for a very long journey. Enough for a man ready to lay down and die, to choose to live another day. This summer, the Episcopal Church met in its every three-year general convention, which is the governing body of our church. One of the resolutions was to establish the Missionary Diocese of Navajo Land. Navajo Land in our church is the geographic area of that ministry, and it's been called a ministry area. Navajo Land ranges over multiple states and is a reservation for Native people. And our ministry there has been called a ministry area and not a diocese because there wasn't enough money there wasn't enough money generated locally to qualify as an independent diocese, which means that you can afford a bishop and the structures of church. So a technical problem from our view, can they afford to be a missionary diocese? But a profound problem of autonomy and leadership and ministry development for the people of Navajo land. So in the course of passing this resolution, which of course, uncontested today, we find appalling that this status had not been given to them earlier. But in the course of passing it, a beautiful, very poetic process, Navajo or Diné people, elders, laypersons, and clergy stepped up to the microphones to tell the convention why this was important and what it meant to them. One elder remembered being blessed by her own community from the visitors gallery of the convention in the past before stepping onto the floor of our convention because it had not been allowed and was a dangerous place and not necessarily a safe place, our church's space of governance and leadership, somehow not safe for the indigenous people of this land, our Christian siblings. I don't know that there was anyone not weeping during this presentation, but I think that was the moment where I started. Our church was a place of marginalizing the indigenous recently, and worse than that, there is a legacy of boarding schools, which we were learning about at that convention together, land theft, and ongoing prejudice in our communities. So as they spoke in Diné and then in English, I found myself standing up, maybe to mark in myself the holiness of the moment. I don't know, but I, like everyone else, on my feet with tears streaming down our faces, their voices, their language, their name for God, who had brought us together despite our histories, the one who had sheltered them, the one who speaks to us today. At the conclusion, the Reverend Cornelia Eaton led a song that they sang together, a song she introduced by saying that it had been sung on the Long Walk, also called the Trail of Tears, the forced 300-mile walk at gunpoint by U.S. federal troops of 10,000 Diné people, their ancestors, through the desert from their homes to a desolate place. Thousands died. They sang a song to us of that time from that walk, to invoke our collective memory, the song of their ancestors, as they proclaimed their dignity and independence in our body. It was simply stunning to witness, like bread on hot stones in a cool vessel of water for the tired traveler prepared to lie down and die, a church wrestling with its diminishment, like so much of the main line, wondering what we are for and what we should look like in this time, who needs us, who can hear us, who speaks for us. More bread that we did not know to ask for, we did not want, but God had said, get up and eat, get up. Some of those speakers are my friends, all people of my faith, calling me to a deeper reckoning with my place in this nation, with indigeneity, the people that have long made bread here, their practices, their ways. Walk in beauty, they say. I hear that means live in balance with all things, the past and future, the created order, our feelings and desires, a new lens or maybe multiple lenses on our holy scriptures, our holy sacraments, the ways we know to be. Beauty is balance, we are told. Elijah the prophet will next travel to Horeb, which is Sinai, for 40 days, 40, the great 40 of meaning-making, of nation-making, sustained by that bread from strangers. Horeb is Sinai. He will wait for his God there to find what is next for him. For him, it will be the choosing of a successor and his final chariot ride. The great man has failed. The heir of Moses, like Moses, will stand in that holy place and plan for a future that is not his. The king has not followed the ways of God and will not. Elijah could not make it happen, despite his mighty acts of power. Isn't it interesting that when the man of God gives up, God sends Bedouins? Or is it that Bedouins practice their hospitality as they know how, even for the man the king wants to kill, the hunted man? So indigeneity is on my mind today, the way God acts among us, the people of the land when the nation builders arrive, who bless us to this day with their beauty and compassion and profound connection to what was before and critical eye towards what is. What we believe are the powers that rule this world, like old King Ahab. God acts through indigenous people, among them, sometimes with us, oftentimes, it seems, despite us, even in those days when a holy man of God, Elijah the prophet, the miracle worker, had no life left in him. So let us watch for bread on hot stones, seek out some pita or fry bread or a tortilla if you can, especially on those days when you have nothing left, when even the miraculous power of God has somehow not won the day. Food for the journey, from the people of the land, enough, until you see God again, face to face.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Winnie Varghese. For a free transcript of her sermon, Walk in Beauty, you can visit us online at dayone.org. Also, those of you already subscribed to our Day One Weekly Update e-newsletter know how much we love bringing you the latest news, insights, and stories straight to your inbox every week. If you're not signed up yet, what are you waiting for? Join our Day One family by subscribing to the Day One Weekly Update today. It's super easy. Just head over to dayone.org and hit that subscribe button. Friends, earlier this summer, the Alliance for Christian Media, which produces Day One, announced our new partnership with the Pitts Theology Library at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. It means work will commence on a new, publicly accessible website that will feature thousands and thousands of sermons from 80 years of Day One and the Protestant Hour broadcasts, and a new digital home for Day One. We are so grateful to Pitts and to Emory. Next week on Day One, don't miss the Reverend Dr. Scott Jose with his new sermon entitled Real Food, an edifying sermon from an excellent teacher of preachers. That's next time on Day One. Winnie, what's something you've learned from ministry with your congregation in the last couple of years?
You know, like everyone else coming out of the pandemic, I feel like a very different kind of priest. And because I've moved, I don't know if that's actually true, but it feels very different to me. Relationship matters so much to me. It matters a lot that we can stay kind of tender and open and intimate with one another. And I think I would have always preached some version of that, but it feels right up at the front in terms of my life as well. And I think it's because we're all so shattered from that year and a half. I don't know how it was for you. I standing at altars alone, you know, for that long and trying to figure out how to care well for people from great distances and missing the most important funerals and sicknesses. I feel so profoundly changed by it. I feel like my sense of why justice is imperative is even more intense. Like why the things I can't see why people deserve that and why we must work for it feels very intense. And I don't have it in me to demonize anyone. Like I just feel really like fragile around needing to see wholeness in people, and seek it and like maybe even like force it, like force people to be, you know, like, and I don't think I thought you could run a big institution that way. I thought that you would get squished to if you were too emotionally available. And I think I was taught that by smart people. And I think it's not untrue in many ways. And I can't do it. I got here and realized I don't have it in me anymore. And I'm glad. And I think I'm a much better leader for it.
That is so rich and healing and hopeful to hear. And I agree. I do think we were socialized to hear over and over again, as perhaps especially as people who are women, that what leadership looked like and that properly holding power and properly preventing too much anxiety rising in a collective meant a certain kind of aggression and a certain kind of leadership and a certain kind of rigidness instead of softness. And just like the changes you were talking about in the denominations, the fast changes aren't always bad ones.
You know, and if I'm going to be a complete jerk about it, you know, because as things fall or fail, you know, we say things, and I partly because our new presiding bishop is brilliant, is kind of leading right into this language of change and failure, basically, of decline. And I find myself very resistant to it. I'm going to be honest, like, I feel very resistant to it. I've never been anywhere that's declining. I've never been a part of a church that's declining. And I haven't always been at the heart of the beast, at the big, you know, big, well-funded ones. But never, like, not in my growing up in immigrant church, they were always growing. I think what we're seeing is the models we said were good have failed. And those leaders failed to establish institutions into the future. That's not just demographics. That's like an incapacity to see the present and the future, to give us model, you know, to lead in ways that were sustainable and humane. We did it wrong. Like, you know, people talk about women and people of color coming in when the thing is failing. I would actually say because we did it wrong. It was wrong. You know, all the abuse we're cleaning up, that wasn't like it was right and the world is different now. It was wrong. We did it wrong. And so we are learning a different way to be. And the pandemic has given us permission. I keep using the pandemic as the permission to make change because I can say, oh, look, neutral. It was the pandemic. We did all these things. And so the difference isn't 500 years we're changing or 50 years we're changing. We're changing from pandemic times. And don't we all want to change from that? But the truth is, a lot of what we did in the pandemic was classic us. What we know, right? It's true. But we've kind of been given this tool to offer a critique of really the last 50 years, maybe 75, like post-World War II church. And I don't know. I'm saying people are receiving it, but frankly, we just elected a presiding bishop who's still kind of a little bit in that message. But maybe that's where leadership has to be at that level. You know, that like it's not maybe the job of leadership to be cutting edge, right? But that sense of like we're not right sizing. I think we did a lot of things really wrong. Really wrong, trying to protect a certain way of being. And I think it's what those Navajo elders were saying to us. There's another way to be. You know, and it's drawing sustenance, and sustenance is resource. It's drawing it from a different place. And I think when we do that, that's where every tradition we're all from, there are places that are thriving, and not because they're rich, because plenty of rich places are failing. And even if I disagree with people's politics, they're drawing up something of a local resource of power, right? And that, like, that's what we're supposed to be doing. And you can do that and not become an abusive alcoholic. You absolutely can. I believe it.
Without exploiting each other, without hurting each other.
Well, and we've had a woman, we've had folks of color, we have all kinds of leadership, but if we are leading in the same way, what does it matter? You know, I just don't know that just the representation is, I mean, I can say this as an Indian, like when you look at Indians in the politics right now, whew, where you are, where I am in India, like representation isn't it, right? Like that's not it. It's like, what are you, like, that's not inspiring enough for me. Like, what are you bringing to the table that is actually wholly engaging in ways? And if it's not sustainable to run a big thing, then let's have smaller things. But I actually don't agree that it isn't. There are ways to be whole and authentic in these systems and to invite people to that as well.
And to be aligned for everyone's flourishing.
Yeah.
To be aligned for everyone's flourishing. You really can be big. It doesn't have to be, like, just as soon as you get a lot of people together, it doesn't guarantee exploitation and running from God. You know, like lots of people through time have figured out how to be big together of and with God and move towards everyone's flourishing.
Yeah. And that's what we're supposed to be doing, right? And I even the story of like Elijah and Moses and this, you know, this sense of like this messianic lineage that's the reading today, right? Of the struggle. I feel like the Bible kind of lays out both the psychological struggle, the emotional struggle, the people organizing struggle. Like, there it is. How beautiful. Like, why wouldn't we? And the Bedouin somehow make it in there? Like, how beautiful. And if we don't know about them, we don't know how to read that story. We say God provides. I mean, that's fine, but you just missed a really beautiful part of that story, which is, oh, look, there were some indigenous people that saw a hungry man and weren't afraid of him, probably knew who he was, and kept him going. Like, isn't that our story?
It is our story. And I have to say, when you got to that part, I was like, I want to go look up how to make Bedouin bread. Like, you opened up my thinking about the word indigenous and thinking about, like, wait, that doesn't mean we're not always counting back to the origin of where people first were, because people always migrate and move. Yeah. It really is it's a time-bound concept. And what does that mean for, you know, for you and your story? It, you know, you mentioned that this interests you because you are a person whose ancestors are from a place where you'd been for a long time, colonizers came in, and that you live in a place where others have been removed, et cetera. Just say, would you say some more just about your personal history and what indigenous meant as you opened up that word?
Yeah, so I read an article that Danya Ruttenberg, who's a rabbi, posted in the beginning of the Israel-Palestine war that we currently have, right? Like the Gaza war, about what is indigeneity? Like what is indigenous? Because that's somewhat at the heart of that conflict. And it was a beautiful rethinking of why would you need the term? Because there are these two things to hold in tension, which is people move. It's the nature of the thing from the beginning, or we'd all be in Central Africa right now, right? That people move and have moved through time, and that's a neutral. It's not a good or a bad. And that that the colonial movements have marked us. And that's something I think we struggle with in American history, because we don't really learn about it in this way, but Indians do, right? Mm-hmm. I'm from India. So like keep trying to understand my history, like my parents' history, has meant I've had to think about that. And the colonial movements are fascinating to study because, like Nicole Hannah-Jones' work, when you look at enslavement and you look at the movements around that, so many things fall into place. You're like, whoa, there's everything's connected to this. And colonialism is the same way. Like the stock market comes from enslavement and colonialism, right? The East India Company, which like is connect, like the flag of the East Indian Company is basically that's where the American flag comes from. Like what? Like how is the United States and India connected? Yes.
What? I didn't know that.
It's the same colonial moment is why. Like where did the tea come from for the Boston Tea Party?
Sure.
Right?
Yes.
Like the same leaders and the British movements, like those colonial movements are in America. And then when they leave the US because of the war, they go to India. Many of them go make their careers in India. All of this is connected. And so the more we understand it, the more I think we get away from an American sense of kind of who are the innocent ones, the good ones. Because the story of Zion and the story of Israel and of the US is an empty land and a needy people. And for our freedom, we come to this place, and we are innocent of the. There happens to be some fallout. I learned in Texas history that there were indigenous people, but they all died, and there weren't any left in Texas. And I remember hearing it and thinking, "Holy! Like, what does that mean?" You know, and there was no explanation of how. And I mean, it's horrifying to imagine that's true, and it's not true.
Yes.
And it's not true. There are still those people, right?
Right.
Look, all the parts. So for me, I think the reason it's important is we in this country haven't wrestled with that. In the UK, they haven't really wrestled with that in a way like that, because it makes us not innocent, and life isn't innocent. And we don't need Jesus if we are innocent, right? Like life is all like the creation is fallen, right? Mr. Calvin has told us like that it's extremely complex, and our lives are caught up in the give and take of economies and people and money. And the colonial moment was particularly brutal. It was. And there's been brutality before, and there'll be brutality again. But that moment has defined our politics and our economics in a way that isn't necessarily natural, which is how we are taught it is natural, that capitalism emerged from the ether alongside Eve. And really what happened is colonialism happened. And it's a particularly exploitative way to organize ourselves. And we've organized everything around it. So indigeneity and indigenous is a way to say there were people that these things happen to, which begin to, and they're still around, but it begins to open up for us another lens on colonialism, because we hear about it in a very particular way, and on who we are. And so my parents are from South India. We have been there a long time. When they do genetic studies, they're somehow, I don't know the science enough to understand this, but in the hills that we come from that are mountains, the Western Ghats, they have found basically replicas of the first genetic strain. So, and there's this really sweet video of this guy who's like in a village. He's really thin and old, and he's got this big like smile. He's got a bunch of teeth missing, and they found it in him. which means they have a direct genetic link to to the central and southern part of Africa where that first human being, those first people decided to start walking. And so the way the story is told is the migratory patterns are hunter-gatherer patterns. So they go up the coast of Eastern Africa and go through what is now the Middle East down into South India. You could walk that. You're just
a fertile crescent kind of thing. Yeah. And
you come all the way, cause you're just following the berries and the herds or whatever. So you get to the bottom of India. And then basically it says, and then they go back up. They keep following and they go up and they go around. And then there were some people, my ancestors, who were like, oh, it's nice here. We'll stay. There's mangoes and coconuts and a beach and we're good.
Sounds smart.
And that guy is like, and so they have him like gap tooth smiling and then they like pan out to the whole village. They all have it. So there's definitely domestic, there's farms and like you can find culture for a long time, but also just the fact of this genetic pool in this place that's tropical and hot, so things decay. So you have things from the 600s or what, but you don't have things from like 10,000 years ago necessarily, but there's that guy saying these people
were
here.
Guy.
So I come from this place where we've been around forever and I was raised in America and I'm a Christian. So I have this sense of like, oh, that's where we're innocent. I'm in India.
Yeah.
Right. Or I'm a woman or I'm queer or there's this innocence. I find it in myself. And of course we're not, right? Because that guy is in the hills where tribal people are still barely making it on the land that people like my parents can go by. And my ancestors did go by to make sure they were displaced because they weren't governed in the way that those of us from the princely state were, that it's always complex in those ways. And that if anything, it's that drive to be the innocent one that I think should be how we interrogate ourselves. And then to come here, the only reason I can come here, my country, my family is here, is because of the Civil Rights Act, which reversed the Anti-Asian Exclusion Act, which meant that Asians could immigrate. Right. That was in the Civil Rights Act. So it was illegal for us to be here before then. We could come. And to our great shock, people weren't that excited that we were coming. And we came to do college degrees because that's what we were allowed to come to do. We couldn't come to do other things. We couldn't just show up and work, right? We had to. So a certain group of us came, but we came to a place settled, right? Where my friend Cornelia Eaton's family walked the Trail of Tears and now live on this reservation where they can do, there are very, very few things they can do if they stay on that reservation, right? But I could come and live in this economy where that is built for me to be, to provide a certain level of input into this economy as an Indian. And I'm an Indian and she's an Indian, right? Like standing in that complexity, I think is the beautiful place to stand. I don't know what balance is in it, but standing in it, being truthful to it. And for me, resisting my desire to be the good one in it.
Standing in it, being truthful in that beauty and that complexity. I thank you for modeling that. I know I am continually hungry for friends and colleagues and models for how to do that well. How to resist looking for a purity badge, how to live with the complexity, even when I'm implicated in it, and to stay there and to be hungry for truth, and then to be motivated to really love well. That's the best, right?
What a great way to say that.
Well, I really feel like that's what I heard from your sermon. And you gave us such a gift today, Winnie. Really, really, really appreciate it. Thank you for who you are, what you keep giving. And I can't wait till the next time you're on Day One.
I'm so glad you guys are doing this still. Love the podcast. Love that.
You've been listening to Day One, the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches for 79 years, proclaiming God's hope for a hurting and divided world. Day One is produced by the Alliance for Christian Media. Visit us online at dayone.org. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim, wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.